By 11 o'clock, she began pacing. She was silly to think that he'd remember to stop by. He'd surely be there in the morning, apologizing and carrying sketches for her to look over. Mrs. Camden and the children and that baby, the new one, kept coming to mind. What were their lives like? Did they miss Theo, feel the absence of his interest? Or did he turn into another person entirely when he stepped over the threshold of their door? One who made up for the long hours away with smiles and hugs and presents. She couldn't bear it. The hour was late enough that the children would have been put to bed by now. All she wanted was to walk past their door. The one he went through and became an unknown presence to her. The pain of being apart, of not knowing every inch of him, drove her out of the quiet safety of her rooms. She tiptoed down the stairway to the west side of the building. When she turned the corner to their hall, she froze. A ghost of a small child stood in the middle of the hallway, about 20 feet away. Sarah stifled a scream, and the ghost did as well, the two of them terrified by each other. Peering through the dim light, Sarah recognized one of the twins, Lula. She wore only her nightdress and gave a small hiccup. Sarah wasn't seeing things. This was indeed an actual human being. As she drew near, she noticed that the girl's face was red and streaked with tears. "Lula, what are you doing out here?" She knelt down and took the girl's hands in her own. The girl shook her head, unable to speak, and fell sobbing into Sarah's arms.
"What's wrong? Where's your mother?"
"Inside. She's sick. She told me to get help, but I don't know where to go."
"Why didn't you fetch a servant or ring downstairs?"
"They're all gone out tonight. And after Mother caught me playing with the electric bell, she told me never to use it again."
"Poor girl. There now, I'm here."
Sarah held Lula's hand as they entered the front door. Only a few lamps were lit, and the place was full of gloom and shadows. From the far rooms came the sound of a baby crying.
"Show me where your mother is."
An eerie tableau greeted Sarah when she opened the door to the main bedchamber. Mrs. Camden lay on the bed, her skin as pale as the pillow. Emily and Luther stood around her silently, patting her arms. They barely moved as Sarah drew closer.
"Mrs. Camden."
The woman opened her eyes and tried to speak, but her breath caught in her throat.
"Don't talk. I'll call for the doctor."
"Thank you."
Her lips were chapped and her eyelids fluttered and then closed. Sarah went to the kitchen, Lula trailing behind her like a dutiful sheepdog. Why was there no one home? And where was Theo? She rang the bell for the night porter and met him out in the hallway to tell him to call for a doctor right away. The baby's wailing had grown louder by the time she returned. Lula shrugged.
"He won't stop crying. He wants Mother."
A lump caught in Sarah's throat. She didn't want to see or make any kind of contact with Theo's new ward. This boy that was now part of his family. When the boy she should have had was gone, buried in an unmarked grave on that hellish island. But she couldn't stand the desperation that grew with each cry. The child had thrown off all his bedclothes and was circling his arms and legs, such chubby limbs, like he was trying to swim to the surface of a pond. His peony pink mouth was open in a big O, while his eyes were closed tight. She leaned over and picked him up. He weighed more than she'd expected. She sat on the rocking chair next to the crib and tucked him into her, bouncing him softly in her arms. Lula spoke with a reverent hush.
"He's hardly ever quiet."
"He's hungry, perhaps." Lula just shrugged. "Where is your nanny?"
"Not here this week. Traveling to some place or other."
"Your mother is alone with you?"
"Yes."
Has she been ill long? The girl sighed.
Forever, it seems.
Theo should have been back, taking care of his family, who obviously needed him, needed someone to take charge. Sarah rose, the baby still in her arms, and walked back to the bedchamber. Mrs. Camden opened her eyes and looked up at the ceiling, as if she were trying to remember where she was. Her head slowly turned in Sarah's direction, and she stared for several moments without blinking. Her expression was neither grateful nor hateful, but she knew everything. Of that, Sarah was certain. When the doctor arrived, followed by a nurse as well as Mrs. Haynes, Sarah reluctantly put the boy back down in his crib. He was fast asleep and didn't stir, although she waited a few moments in case the lack of human contact brought him out of his slumber. Part of her wished it might. Unnoticed, she slipped out of the Camden apartment and back up the stairs to her own.
Chapter 27. New York City, September 1985. The work on Melinda's apartment reached a feverish pitch over the next week, swarmed by painters who transformed the dark walls and columns into swaths of faux marble and stucco. Melinda had insisted they paint a long trompe-l'oeil crack in the living room wall, so that it resembled a Parisian apartment she'd seen in a French movie, the kind that were once grand but had gone to elegant seed. In the meantime, Bailey successfully distracted herself from beginning each day with a shot of vodka by going to an AA meeting in Midtown before hitting furniture showrooms. She'd even found a sponsor, a retired theater publicist named Lydia, who had a deep-throated laugh and a wicked intuition. Bailey hadn't been back to the 69th Street meeting, and on the few occasions she ran into Renzo, she tried to be polite but not too forthcoming. Melinda had warned her to stay away from him until the lawyers came to an agreement. They were deep in negotiations with the co-op board and the Met to determine who owned the rights to the sheath, all dependent on the completion of the DNA testing. While Melinda had warned her away from Renzo, she hadn't said anything about the Camdens' family advisor. Bailey had located him using the Yellow Pages and gotten an appointment 2 days later. The offices, as expected, were formidable for a firm that handled generations of clients' money. Mahogany walls, a mid-century sofa in the waiting room, and a receptionist who looked as if she sucked on lemons in between phone calls. "Miss Camden." An older man in a well-cut suit beckoned her into his office. He had a long face and a chin that reminded her of Dick Van Dyke, whom she'd developed a mad crush on as a young girl.
"I'm Fred Osborne. Very nice to meet you."
"Yes, thank you for seeing me." She took a chair opposite his desk and looked about. Behind him, on the window ledge, were dozens of trophies, the kind that children receive for signing up for a soccer league. He caught her looking at them.
"My grandchildren's. Their rooms were overrun with the things, and they insisted I display them here."
She liked him already. "Mr. Osborne, I won't take up too much of your time, but I want to be tested to find out if I am a true Camden, not only in name, but in blood." He studied her, no reaction on his face.
"First off, please call me Fred. Now, what makes you think you might be? I know about the ward, your grandfather, but you think you're related to Theodore and Minnie Camden?"
"Not exactly. Theodore Camden, yes. I believe he had an affair with the woman who killed him, Sarah Smythe, and that Christopher Camden was the result." She explained what she had discovered and dug into her handbag to show him the cottage drawing, the letter, and the photo. "You see, I discovered the sheath and bone. I think it's only fair that I be included in the DNA testing."
"What do Melinda and Manville think of this idea?"
"I don't know about Manville, but I know Melinda isn't too pleased."
"I can imagine."
His eyes were guarded, but she got a hint of impatience in his face at the mention of Melinda's name.
I have to warn you, at this point, the provenance of the sheath is hazy. You would think the government of Tibet might be interested, but they're being bullied by China, who are trying to destroy Tibetan culture. The Rutherford family, who owned it in the 1880s when it was stolen, has died out and there are no descendants. At this point, it may indeed end up in the hands of either the co-op for the Dakota or Melinda and Manville.
I don't understand why the co-op is trying to stake a claim. I mean, it was found in the man's trunk along with his finger bone.
Mainly for the sake of precedence. Not to mention the finances of the co-op are consistently in the red.
He shrugged.
And my guess is that Melinda Camden isn't high on the list of their favorite shareholders.
I know Melinda is concerned about the sheath, but as far as I'm concerned, it belongs in the Met with the knife. I'm more interested in the DNA sampling. When is the package being sent out? She asked. Or has it already?
It goes out Monday. They'll be sending along the bone you discovered and the blood samples from the plans and the sheath. Turns out the bone is the key to the testing. Without that, Melinda would have had little chance of getting back any results either way.
He rubbed his chin.
I've learned more about the science behind this testing than I'd have thought possible this past week. Fascinating stuff.
I'd like to know if I'm a Camden for real or not. I hope you can understand my position.
I do, Miss Camden. The evidence you've assembled, if we may call it that, is quite interesting. The trust was set up, as common in that era, for the descendants by blood of the trustor, Theodore Camden. Today, with all these scientific breakthroughs, we can take that quite literally. My duty as trustee requires that I distribute equal portions of the funds held in trust to all living heirs of Theodore Camden on their 30th birthdays. I could make the argument that in my capacity as trustee, I'm honor-bound to test you, to determine once and for all if you are entitled to be brought into the trust. But even if I were so inclined, I'm afraid it wouldn't be possible.
Her heart dropped. Why's that?
The testing has to be done via the mail line. For example, we can connect Theodore Camden to Melinda's twin, Manville, by way of Luther Camden and their father, in which case, along with all the newspaper accounts of the murder and such, we should be able to prove that the sheath was part of the family's items. But you can't be matched, being a female, I'm sorry to say, unless you have a brother.
So close. No luck there. But what about my father? What if he agreed to be tested? His father was Christopher Camden, so that would be a direct line, if Christopher is indeed Theodore Camden's son.
That would work. He's still living.
She nodded.
In that case, we'd test him. And if it's a match, he would be added as a beneficiary of the trust. You would inherit what is left, and so on down through your descendants. Would your father agree to be tested?
I'll ask him. Maybe if she explained it the right way, he'd agree and take part in her crazy plan. He had to see that it was for her future, and for their family name, their rights.
Luckily for the heirs, the architect Henry Hardenberg took over the firm after Theodore Camden's death, and a significant portion of the profits went into the Camden Trust each year. My family's company has handled the estate since the very beginning, and been strategic in our investment strategy, which has paid off nicely over the past century.
And way back when, they set it up so my grandfather, Christopher, couldn't inherit anything?
I'm afraid not, as he wasn't a blood relative, and they didn't make any other accommodation for him.
I wonder if Theodore might have set aside something for him, if he'd lived.
We'll never know, I'm afraid. Such a tragic death, and quite early in his career.
She rose to go, eager to get Jack on the phone. but Fred raised a hand to stop her.
One more thing. If you do get your father to agree to be tested, I won't be allowed to use any of the Camden family money to cover the expenses, as you can understand.
Right, of course. How much would it cost? He did the figures on a notebook on his desk, using an old fountain pen.
Somewhere around $1,000?
$1,000. She didn't have anything close to that on her. Even if she did get Jack to agree, she had no chance of raising that much money so fast. She closed the door behind her before slinking away. The phone at the house in New Jersey rang and rang, so Bailey tried the repair shop. Her dad had stepped out, but she left a message with Scotty, asking him to call her back right away.
He's out fishing. Probably back in a few hours.
Great. Right when time was of the essence, her dad was out on a boat fishing. To keep herself occupied, she headed down to Kenneth's apartment, where he was holding what he called a high tea. Inside, a dozen or so men and a few women were chatting away in groups, nibbling on cucumber sandwiches and macaroons. Kenneth gave her a quick kiss on the cheek before heading back to the kitchen to refill the trays. Bailey curled up in a nook in one of the large window seats facing Central Park, with a cup of tea and a scone, and let her mind wander. She was so close to finding out the truth. But although she had yet to speak with her dad, there wasn't much point of getting her hopes up. Even if he agreed, there was no way she could afford $1,000 test. A familiar, deep growl broke her out of her reverie. Renzo stood near the fireplace, listening intently as Mrs. Stellenbach, who lived in a studio apartment up on 8, explained some kind of repair job in great detail, barely pausing for breath. He caught her eye and she smiled quickly, then looked away, pretending to be absorbed by a young man plucking away at "You Are My Lucky Star" on the piano. After a few minutes, Renzo put his hand on the woman's shoulder and made his excuses, then joined Bailey on the window seat. It was the first time they'd been face to face since the debacle in the basement with Melinda and Tony.
I assume you can't go to a tea party without being monopolized about a clogged sink.
Clanging radiator, in this case. Hazard of the job. I try not to socialize too much with the tenants, but I couldn't pass up Kenneth's scones.
He leaned back against the wall and studied her. She blushed. To distract him, she asked the question she'd been wondering for weeks. How did you get your unique name?
Is Lorenzo Duffy unique?
She laughed.
My father was Irish and my mother Italian. Deadly combination, as the probability of turning into a boisterous drunk increases twofold. At least, that's my theory.
You seem to be doing all right.
I'm hanging on. How about you?
Meetings every day.
I haven't seen you.
He'd been looking for her. Her heart skipped over a couple of times. Melinda warned me, well, to steer clear, until things have been decided one way or another.
Steer clear of me.
She nodded. Although you were right to stash away the sheath in the safe the way you did, Melinda and Tony were ready to sell the thing on the black market. The fact that it's an artifact, an important one, means nothing to them.
To you it does.
Of course. She looked out the window, the view of a sea of sparkling leaves. Okay, I did think about the value. How could I not? But to me, the most important items from those trunks were the letter and the photo. And, in a weird way, the finger.
What's the latest from the Battle of the Basement?
The co-op agreed to allow the results of the DNA test to determine who it belongs to. If the DNA from the finger bone and blood matched that of Manville Camden, it's his and Melinda's.
How are they certain that what's in the tube belonged to Theodore Camden?
The plans are dated the month he died. And there are newspaper accounts about how his finger was never recovered. Grisly details like that.
It all sounds kind of
hocus-pocusy.
She couldn't agree more. I know. It's a crazy mix of old evidence and cutting-edge science. The results will be in by the end of the month. But I don't think I'll even get a chance to get my DNA tested. Although not for lack of trying.
Why not?
She didn't want to go into it. The money, the fact that she wasn't a male.
Long story. It's probably not going to happen.
She paused. Look, I'm sorry if I've kept my distance. I wasn't sure where you stood.
I don't stand with Melinda and Tony, I'll tell you that much. I hear the apartment is a disaster.
She frowned.
God, it's getting worse every day. It sucks that I have to do her bidding. You don't, actually.
Something dark brewed behind his slate-gray eyes. Until I get paid next month, I'm stuck. At that point, I'll have enough to get me through.
Seems to me that you're making excuses, staying in a poisonous relationship because you don't have the courage to break out of it.
She hadn't asked him for his advice, and the implication infuriated her, as did his audacity to analyze her decisions and motives. She'd put herself out there by approaching Fred Osborne, and now having to ask Jack for a favor that she was sure he would deny. You have no idea what I've been trying to accomplish the past couple of days. It's taken every ounce of courage I have.
That's great, because I couldn't stand the way Melinda and Tony treated you down in my office. Like you were beneath them.
He might as well have thrown a bucket of cold water over her. She felt attacked, exposed. He'd seen her prostrate herself before the two of them, and was calling her out. What exactly was I supposed to do? Tell them to include me in the testing or I'll quit? Melinda would have laughed in my face. The power is all theirs. I'm working with reality here.
You don't see in yourself what I see. You have more power than you think.
He was wrong. I'm barely hanging on here. What if it all comes crashing down? You may make fun of Melinda, but she stood by me and given me a chance when no one else would. I can't forget that. If I push to get tested and it turns out I'm not a true Camden, I'll not only lose one of my only friends, I'll be totally banished from the New York design community.
So you would back down in order to placate Melinda. Do you think she would do the same if the roles were reversed?
He touched her shoulder gently, and she bristled in response.
Sometimes, I worry that you're using this wild goose chase to avoid dealing with who you really are. In the end, who cares if you're a real Camden or not? You're a healthy, smart woman with a bright future ahead of you. Which means it doesn't matter if Melinda causes trouble. You'll get a job doing something else. You'll figure it out. What's most important is that you move beyond the tragedy of the past. Start fresh.
She wondered which tragedy he was referring to. Theo Camden's or her mother's. The shock of her mother's death, as if it had happened 12 hours ago, not 12 years, hit Bailey in the gut, and she struggled to catch a breath. This usually happened in the middle of the night, when she woke up, heart pounding, certain that the world was disintegrating beneath her, not in the middle of a crowded party. Renzo continued on, taking her silence for encouragement.
I understand what it's like to be barely sober, barely hanging on. But I want to see you stand up for yourself and be counted, not get pushed around by a prick like Tony or a princess like Melinda.
I'm confused here. Are you telling me to demand to get tested or to give it up?
Not my decision. Whatever you do, don't go into it blindly, for the wrong reasons. Or expected to solve all your problems. That's all I'm saying.
Before she could reply, Kenneth came over, pulling two of his friends.
How many more of those sketches do you have, my dear?
He pointed to the one that was now hanging above his fireplace in a handsome frame. Far too many. She'd gone crazy the last couple of days, trying to capture the building from every angle, as if it might disappear when she no longer lived there. She knew it was silly, but her obsession blunted the pain of having to move on.
Rory, John, and Edward all want one. I spoke with my neighbors and have already sold 6 here in the building. I won't charge you a commission. Yet.
She did the math. That would do it. She'd have enough to pay for the DNA testing. You're amazing, Kenneth.
You have no idea.
She gave him a huge hug before he was swooped up by another guest. Renzo stood and began to congratulate her, but she stopped him. I know what you're trying to say, and I appreciate it. I realize I have to figure this out on my own. The confusion in his face crushed her. He fixed her with a serious look, all shadow and gravity.
In meetings, they say to stay on your own side of the street. For some reason, this has me all stirred up. I guess because all this, the building, the tenants, the history inside these walls, it means something to me. I know it affects you the same way.
He lifted both hands and let them fall to his sides.
As a matter of fact, you mean something to me.
Her breath caught in her throat and she looked away, overcome. The pianist's last note quivered in the air before dissipating. Renzo took a couple of steps back.
Sorry. I veered into your lane there. I'm normally a much better driver.
Thanks. If she had had the courage, she'd have let him know how much his concern meant to her. But he'd caught her off guard. And she had to get to Jack. There was no time to smooth things over. I appreciate it. I really do. But I gotta go.
You're kidding, right?
Bailey's father sounded tired when she finally reached him at 8 o'clock that night. Apparently the fishing had been fruitless, or rather, fishless, which, from past experience, meant his mood would be impatient and surly. So she botched the explanation of her meeting with Fred Osborne and the DNA testing, all logic lost in a nervous dribble of words. Jack had been confused at first, and then wary, before she'd finally gotten around to the urgency of his taking a blood test to prove that they were indeed real Camdens. I'm not kidding, Dad. I hope you'll consider doing this for me. For us. She'd learned to use consider from Tristan, which was employed when they wanted to push a client beyond their budgetary comfort zone. It softened the request, and almost everyone took the bait, believing they'd made a conscious choice, when in fact, the decision had already been made for them.
How much did you say this testing costs?
I didn't, because I am paying for it myself.
How much, though?
He insisted. She told him.
You're going to blow a grand on the hopes that you land a bigger fish? Why on earth would you want to do that?
She didn't bother making a joke about the fish metaphor. I have the money and I don't mind spending it on this. I know I'm right. I'm absolutely sure of it. There's research and documentation to back it up. Of course, if the test came back negative, not only would she be out a grand, but there'd be no chance of getting any payment for all her work from Melinda, who'd be livid at Bailey's workaround. She'd be right back at square one. Through the receiver came labored breathing.
My father wanted nothing to do with that family, and for good reason. I regret the day I allowed your mother to get us back under their influence. I don't see why neither of you are able to settle for what you already have.
He spoke as if her mother were still alive, which broke Bailey's heart and pissed her off at the same time. We have 2 different perspectives. She kept her voice even, trying to persuade him, not put him on the defensive any more than he already was. The way I see it, and the way Mom saw it, was that it's a big world out there,
You and Granddad hid from it, and Mom and I didn't.
It's not a matter of hiding. You've been trying to run from me ever since you were in high school. Like you're ashamed of me, who I am.
She couldn't deny that it wasn't true, because it was. I want more out of my life. What's so wrong with that?
So go ahead and go after it.
That's exactly what I'm doing. But I need you. The blood sample has to come from the male line. From Theodore Camden to Granddad to you.
Here's what I don't get. You disappear for months at a time, then call demanding me to prove I'm related to a family my father despised?
The words stuck in her throat. I was in rehab, Dad. I should have told you earlier, but I wasn't sure how. I'm sorry.
When did you get out?
Last month. Silence. She pictured him shaking his head, his shoulders caving in under the weight of disappointment.
You're battling the same demons as my father. I saw what it cost him.
He was getting the conversation off topic, and she refused to be deterred. Maybe there are some long-lost family members who deserve to be brought into the light, ones that your father never even knew about. I've been reading about the madhouse where Sarah Smythe was sent to. It's horrifying. The suffering she most likely endured. The woman who might very well be your grandmother.
What you're doing here, trying to unravel the past, is no good.
His irritation radiated through the phone line.
Whatever happened back then, in madhouses or fancy apartment houses, has nothing to do with us, with you. I know who I am. I run an auto repair shop, and when I have free time, I go out on the ocean and fish. That's it, but it's real. You, meanwhile, are chasing ghosts. Stop muddying your life up with all this crap.
How dare he tell her what to do? First Renzo, now this? She might have made bad decisions in the past, but she was trying to make amends. In the meantime, there was a good chance she shared a bloodline with a woman who'd fought her own demons and lost. Bailey refused to let that happen to her. And Sarah Smythe was the key to figuring out how. Certainly not through any of the men in her life who had let her down when she'd needed them most. Jack was the one who'd retreated into a shell since his wife's death, letting his daughter run amok in the city with no guidance, no refuge. Her voice cracked as it always did when she was livid.
I've admitted I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to meetings. I've been trying to stay sober. You may not have the same drinking problems, but I learned all about dry drunks in rehab. They're withholding, negative, defensive. That's you. So don't think that you're any better than me or Granddad, or that you've escaped the past.
For a few seconds, she couldn't hear anything other than the blood pounding in her ears, until it was replaced by the faint click of Jack hanging up and the dull murmur of a dead phone line.
Chapter 28. New York City, October 1885. Where were you? Sarah didn't waste any time when Theo came into work the next morning. She followed him into his office and closed the door. The air behind him smelled of sweat and alcohol, although he looked fine. Fresh, almost.
Good morning to you, too.
Your wife was ill last night, and there was no one there to take care of her. Your daughter was out in the hallway, the boy crying in his crib.
With a deep sigh, Theo hung up his coat and hat on the coat rack. He didn't bother answering right away. Instead, leafed through the stack of correspondence she'd put on the corner of his desk.
Has the check from Mr. Smith Roberts arrived?
The audacity of the question, and lack of response to her own, stunned.
You are trying to change the subject.
He rubbed his eyes, and for a brief moment a look of utter exhaustion crossed his features.
No, I am not trying to change the subject. Minnie needs to be sent back upstate. The doctor is insisting on it, and that sum will cover part of the funds to do so.
I see. She sat down in the chair opposite him, still unwilling to offer any comfort. Yes, it did come, and I'll deposit it today. He smiled and stared at her as if for the first time.
You are a goddess, Sarah. I am sorry to put you through what you went through last night. I have tried so hard to keep you and my family separate, as I promised to do.
Where were you?
I ran into a couple of potential clients on the train back. They invited me to the Murray Hill Hotel for a drink. And as they are planning on building on a plot they own on Broadway, I thought it was a good idea to go. For the business. For us.
She had worked herself up into a lather over nothing. The Dakota had the ability to do that, to make you feel like you were the only person within its walls, causing you to become desperate for human contact, particularly at night. The loneliness would dissipate upon awakening the next day, as it had on other nights. He picked up on her uncertainty.
I know I seem ungrateful, but I am very, very pleased you were there. Minnie had sent the maid home and then fell into a fever. It was all a terrible mess.
His eyes grew teary, his face red.
I should have been home. I had no idea.
She stood so she blocked the draftsman's view through the glass window and lowered her voice.
You couldn't have known. I'm sorry I was so hard on you. It was a frightening scene.
He took out his handkerchief and dabbed at his eyes.
Once again, you've saved the day. Minnie said to say thank you as well.
Will she be all right?
The doctor seems to think so. Says it's common for patients to have recurrences. She was looking brighter this morning, before she left.
What about the children?
The governess is on her way back. The maids are taking care of them. Such is the privilege of living in an apartment house, where the building's housemaids can take charge in an emergency.
She thought of the children in that cavernous apartment without their mother. When is the governess due back?
In 2 days. After all that you've done for me, can I ask yet another favor, Sarah?
Yes, I suppose. She held her breath, not knowing what to expect from him.
This morning, Lula asked for you. Would it be a bother if you could stop by the apartment and say hello? I have that blasted dinner with the Builder Society. Or would that be all right?
The sweet scent of the baby, the way his fingers curled around hers, invaded her senses. She should say no, but there was no way to explain why not, without seeming heartless. Of course.
I wouldn't be able to manage without you.
Thank you, Theo. I'm sorry I was so angry. Later that afternoon, he stopped by her desk and placed a piece of paper face down on it. When she turned it over, it contained an address on 39th Street. She looked up at him. Yes?
Why don't you leave early and stop by there? Ask for a Mr. Carmichael.
Then what?
You'll see. I don't want to give away the secret.
She tucked the address into her satchel and walked along the streets, feeling ever so much lighter. Mrs. Camden being gone again had nothing to do with it, she told herself. Having Theo all to herself again had nothing to do with it. She couldn't help but smile when she came to the address. Singer's sewing machines sold here. The storefront window overflowed with ribbons and fabrics, needles and thread. And in the middle of it all sat a beautiful black machine, just like the kind the tailor in the Dakota had. Mr. Carmichael smiled when she said that Mr. Camden had sent her.
Yes, of course, it's right here. I'll have one of the boys help you bring it to your carriage.
She explained that she didn't have a carriage.
That's fine. We'll get you a hansom cab. There's no way you'll be able to carry this yourself.
The enormous box was wrapped in brown paper and string, with no sign of what was inside. She couldn't wait to get it home. It was like being a little girl again on Christmas Day. Even if the gifts her mother ultimately gave her were a disappointment, a pincushion or a dreary pinafore, the unwrapping was always a delight. Two porters carried it up, opened the box, and extricated a brand new Singer sewing machine. The jet black body was decorated with apple blossom and cornflower decals. The wrought iron legs connected with an intricate, web-like pattern. Walnut inserts in the front of the oak cover lent it the air of a valuable piece of furniture, not a practical machine. Her sewing basket had been stored away in a closet, taken out only for emergency repairs. But now she took it out and spooled black thread on the machine, then laid a scrap of fabric under the needle. Pumping with her feet, she watched as the thread crawled its way up the center of the fabric in perfect, even stitches. She could do anything with this machine. Make a runner to cover the scratches on the dining room table, or a new dressing gown. The Rembrandt's grandfather clock chimed 7. Sarah remembered her promise to check in on the children, and reluctantly packed up her sewing basket and placed the cover over the machine. Downstairs, the Camden flat was in chaos. Emily and the twins were screaming at one another in their room, while the baby cried fat, frustrated tears in the maid's arms. Sarah had hired the maid before she'd been sent away to Blackwell's, an Irish girl named Siobhan, who seemed overwhelmed by the noise and commotion. "Let me take him." Sarah lifted the boy up and put him over her shoulder, patting his back.
"I'm so sorry, ma'am. I'm not quite sure what the children are going on about, but I can't get them to stop fighting."
The girl looked worn and miserable. "Have you had your supper yet, Siobhan?"
"No, miss. There's been no time."
"Then down you go to the servants' dining room. Get yourself something to eat. I'll handle the children until then."
"Thank you, ma'am. I won't be long."
Siobhan bobbed her head and hightailed it out of the flat. As soon as the door closed behind her, Christopher let out a loud burp, followed by a sigh. "You were unhappy then, my boy, but now you're all right." She kissed him on the head, covered with fine black swirls of hair. A beautiful boy, in such a sad position. An orphan child. In the twins' room, Emily had hoarded all of the dolls, which were piled up on her bed. She sat in front of them, arms crossed, her mouth an angry line. The twins ran to Sarah as she entered the room.
"Emily won't share!"
Both faces featured upturned noses and bow lips, like beautiful dolls themselves.
"I won't because they keep on breaking them. Look!"
As proof, Emily thrust a porcelain doll at Sarah. Indeed, the doll's head had a crack that ran down one side of the forehead.
"I didn't mean to step on her,"
wailed Luther.
"You did. I saw you stomp her on purpose."
Sarah fixed her gaze on each child, one at a time. "Now then, let's stop fighting, shall we? And you'll have to share the dolls, Emily. Perhaps we can divide them up so that every child has the same amount. That way you will each be responsible for the care of your doll, and if something happens, it won't affect the others." Emily looked up at her, dubious.
"Where is Siobhan?"
"She went downstairs to have something to eat. Your father asked me to look in on you. Now, I know it's difficult with your mother away, but Miss Honeycutt will be here in the next couple of days, and then everything will return to normal."
"What if Mother dies?"
Emily spoke with a quiet candor.
"Yes, what if Mother dies?"
the twins echoed. "I have no doubt the doctor will take very good care of her." Sarah should stop speaking. She didn't know anything about the situation, and was possibly giving them a false hope. But her job was to comfort them, and this was the best she could do, under the circumstances. For now, shall we divide up the dolls? Then I'll ring up for some sweets. Today was Thursday, when the downstairs chef made pineapple pudding.
Yes, please!
Luther twirled about with excitement.
I'll take the doll with the cracked head. I don't mind.
Sarah smiled. She put Christopher down in his crib, and he settled in nicely, staring through the slats as they went through dolls of all shapes and sizes, and divided them up. The last one, made of rags, had seen better days, and all the children agreed that it should live in Christopher's crib and be his first doll. When she laid the doll beside him, he gave her a silly, drunken smile. She rang for the pudding, and the four of them had a tea party in the bedchamber, full of giggles and gentle teasing. When Siobhan's footsteps were heard trudging down the hall, Sarah reluctantly gave her goodbyes, promising to return soon. By then, Christopher was fast asleep. Even after Miss Honeycutt's return, Sarah stopped in daily to visit with the children, either before or after she returned from work. When Miss Honeycutt needed a break, Sarah'd take them up to the roof promenade and let them run around, while she held Christopher in her arms. Although Mrs. Kansan had been gone less than a week, something about having her away, winning this temporary reprieve from the very fact of her in their lives, had made her and Theo even bolder. He slept in her bed most evenings, and she welcomed his presence, even if she couldn't sleep through the night with him there. She would lie awake, wondering how much longer they had. He didn't seem to mind that she was getting closer to his children. For the past two nights, instead of lying awake in bed, listening to Theo's snores, Sarah crawled out and slipped on her dressing gown before sitting down at the sewing machine. Its whir made her heart sing. Deep into the night, she would work on her fancy new machine with fabric she bought at Stewart's department store. First up were sashes for the girls and a necktie for Luther, all in different shades of blue, from cyan to a deep azure. For Christopher, she had already made a sailor outfit with a navy collar and matching tie. In the back of her mind, she knew she was trying to make up for the baby she'd lost, trying to prove to Theo that she was a perfect mother, much better than his wife. This morning, in the depths before dawn, she had wished the woman would die. She'd almost run her own finger under the needle and barely missed getting an awful prick, as if the machine had understood her selfish sentiment and decided to punish her. On Friday evening, when Sarah went downstairs to tuck the children into bed, Theo announced that he had a surprise for them all for the next day. The kids pressed him for information, and he held off for a couple of minutes, telling them that he couldn't possibly let on about the secret, or they'd never be able to get to sleep. Which, of course, only served to rouse them more.
"Please tell us!"
Emily was now standing on her bed, jumping up and down. "You might as well. They will never sleep as it is now," said Sarah.
"All right, then. Tomorrow we're all going to see the ship carrying the Statue of Liberty."
Sarah had read about it in the papers, that the enormous sculpture, packed up in pieces on a French ship, had finally arrived in New York Harbor. Great festivities were planned for Saturday, including a parade of yachts. The children erupted into cheers, but crawled back into bed after promising to be ready to go at precisely 7 o'clock the next morning. In the brougham going downtown on Saturday, Sarah sat next to Theo, with Christopher on her lap, and Emily and the twins lined up on the other side, chattering away to one another. Christopher wore his pretty sailor outfit. The girls had insisted on their sashes, and Luther wore his necktie. They looked like the perfect family, which they were not. Sarah couldn't shake a feeling of unease. "Theo, are you sure I should be in attendance with you?"
"Who else? Miss Honeycutt's a bore."
"I mean, people will talk."
"Let me worry about them. You enjoy yourself. You deserve some fun after how hard I've been making you work, Miss Smythe."
She'd gone back to using Miss after returning from Blackwell's, and it made her feel ridiculously dainty and young to hear it on his lips. Theo climbed out of the carriage first, then turned to help out Sarah and the baby. Emily came next, with Lula leaping out behind her. Theo turned to Luther, irritated. When the child pulled back from his hand, planning on jumping down as his sister had done, Theo reached out and grabbed his arm, hard.
Act like a gentleman.
Yes, Papa.
The boy rubbed his arm and went to stand beside his twin, grumbling softly. Maybe Theo wasn't as unconcerned about their appearance together as he let on. She didn't like the way he took it out on the children, though. Theo led them to a landing beside an enormous yacht. Before getting on board, a photographer asked to take their picture. Theo declined, but the children insisted Sarah stand with them, holding the baby. The man scribbled down their address and promised to put it in the post after Theo had given him 25 cents. The ship filled up with passengers, and Sarah and the children found a spot to sit at the rear, while Theo wandered about and hobnobbed with the dignitaries and businessmen on board. As the yacht headed out into the harbor, Emily, Lula, and Luther squealed with delight, and Christopher slept in Sarah's arms, lulled by the rocking of the waves. How different this journey through the harbor was from the last. When Sarah had arrived a little over a year ago, she was a lowly housekeeper. Now she was an assistant to an architect and lived in a flat in one of the newest and most splendid buildings in New York City. How far she'd come.
There it is!
The captain cried out from behind the helm and pointed at a great ship with a white hull out near the Narrows. Sarah pointed out the French flags, and their vessel joined a parade of similar ones, all lined up behind the French frigate. A band on a neighboring ship played La Marseillaise, but the music was soon drowned out by the horns of the steamships and the deafening roar of cannon fire from Fort Wadsworth and Fort Hamilton. The noise was too much for Christopher, who began to fuss. Finally, Theo returned.
What a day! Are the young ones enjoying themselves?
They certainly are. It's too much for him, though.
A couple who lived on the Dakota's third floor wandered by. Sarah smiled up at them, but the man stared, and his wife made a point of turning away. Her face reddened.
I feel we are making an embarrassment of ourselves. It could hurt your business.
You know what I wish.
Theo placed his hand on hers. She wanted to pull it away, stop anyone from seeing their intimacy, but he held it firm.
I wish Minnie wouldn't come back at all.
Christopher began to cry. She rocked him gently. He's overwhelmed by the noise. You shouldn't say things like that.
Why not? We're both thinking it. I know that makes me a terrible person, but then I could marry you, and you could move in with me where you belong. I hate what I'm doing to your life.
I love my life. I love the children. I love you.
My dear, we will figure this out, I assure you. To think that I almost lost you. What a mistake that would have been. Please have faith in me.
It was the most he'd spoken of his feelings in a while. They'd both been under such stress. As if on cue, Christopher began to wail. The ship was close to shore, and Sarah offered to take him back to the apartment house so Theo and the other children could carry on to the speeches in front of City Hall. How she wished she could keep speaking with him, but the moment was too raw, too exposed. Back in the dim light of the Dakota, the air was heavy and thick, and there was no sign of Miss Honeycutt. Christopher had calmed down in the carriage, but now his fussiness resurfaced. She undressed him, lifting his outfit up over his head. He gave a deep sigh and promptly fell asleep. His skin was as pale and smooth as an eggshell, the blue veins beneath it like a map of crisscrossing rivers. He was no one's child, really, so he might as well be hers. The front door opened and shut. The governess returning from gossiping about Theo and Sarah's arrangement with the other staff, most likely. Sarah didn't care. Theo loved her. That was what mattered. The air changed imperceptibly. The scent of rosewater. Sarah twirled around. Mrs. Camden had returned. Chapter 29. New York City. October 1885. The woman who stared back at Sarah was a completely different person from the sickly patient who'd been carted off a week ago. Mrs. Camden looked almost regal, wearing a handsome black and cream silk afternoon dress. The only giveaway of her illness were the creases under her eyes, and gray shadows that emerged even under a coating of powder. "Miss Smythe?" "Mrs. Camden?" Sarah took her hand off the side of the crib and stood limply, trapped. Mrs. Camden walked over to the crib, and Sarah moved out of the way, allowing her by. But Mrs. Camden didn't reach down, smooth the blanket. Nothing at all maternal. Just stared at the boy, as if she'd never really seen him before. The sailor outfit hung over the rails at the head of the crib. "What's this?" Mrs. Camden fingered the material. "A sailor dress I sewed. While you were away, Miss Honeycutt asked me to help out with the children in a pinch, and I thought this might suit him."
"You made him this?"
"As well as small things for the others." She had meant the statement as a way of showing that her attentions had been equally parsed among the children. But judging from Mrs. Camden's pinched lips, it had come off as possessive.
"I didn't mean to intrude."
Mrs. Camden appraised Sarah from her feet to the top of her head, assessing every inch. She must know. Of course she knew. The servants talked. The other neighbors must have seen Theo coming back from her rooms in the morning. Sarah was no better than her mother, who had succumbed to the advances of the Earl of Chichester with devastating results. The point of coming to America was to escape old habits, the patterns of destruction. She'd wandered right into the thick of it.
"I overstepped. I'm sorry."
Sarah hoped Mrs. Camden would understand the multiple layers of meaning that swirled around the four words. She'd wrought havoc in the home of a sick woman. Like her mother, she'd lose everything. She would take the sashes, necktie, and sailor suit away, store them in her trunk, out of view.
"I must go."
Sarah turned to leave.
"No, wait."
Mrs. Camden's voice was no less than a command. But suddenly her head dipped forward. A trembling hand went to her forehead.
"You're ill. Let me help."
Sarah put her arm around the woman, who leaned into her.
"I feel faint."
"No wonder, returning home to find your husband's lover hanging about in the children's nursery."
"Please, let me make you a cup of tea."
Sarah led her to the kitchen. They didn't speak for a while, as Sarah boiled water, steeped the tea, and then poured it. Being back in the kitchen, instead of one of the formal rooms, made the idea of the two of them having tea together somehow palatable, weirdly cozy. Mrs. Camden took a sip, then placed the cup carefully back on the saucer.
"Where are the others?"
"They're out with Theo, I mean Mr. Camden, at the Statue of Liberty celebrations."
"Emily sent me letters every day that I was away, filled with what you were doing. Together."
"I wanted to help. Mr. Camden seemed out of his element, and Miss Honeycutt..."
She paused.
"Miss Honeycutt is far too concerned with the attentions of the new porter, Davin, these days."
Davin was a strapping boy with dark eyes. Mrs. Camden's acuity surprised Sarah.
"I believe you're right."
Mrs. Camden laughed.
He's a handsome lad.
The children missed you. They are quite lovely, as is Christopher.
Yes, my ward.
An odd way to refer to the boy. Or maybe it was the tone of her voice, like she'd bitten into a fruit and found it to be unripe.
I never formally gave you my apology for accusing you of stealing the necklace. I'm sorry about that. I wasn't sure how to broach the subject. But I should have.
How long ago that time seemed now. Mrs. Camden continued on.
I'm still recovering, and I want you to take care of the children the way you have been.
Are you sure? I don't want to intrude. Maybe she hadn't heard her correctly. Or maybe Mrs. Camden was only saying this for effect, to appear generous.
You should continue taking care of Theo as well.
At this, Sarah's heart pounded. The woman was staring at her, not with malice or judgment. Her face was clear.
Mr. Camden is a difficult man. I don't have the energy right now to handle him in the way he wishes.
Could she be saying what Sarah thought she was? The conversation was tipping over into dangerous territory.
I am happy to work as Mr. Camden's assistant in whatever way necessary. No, I want you to take care of him beyond that.
Mrs. Camden put a hand out on the table, as if she were going to cover Sarah's, but stopped short. Instead, she drummed her fingers on the wood.
Arrangements like this happen all the time.
She looked out the window before adding,
It's quite simple, really.
I don't know what you mean. She fixed her gaze on Sarah. The twins' eyes had the same hazel coloring, the same gold flecks near the iris.
Of course you do. Don't be shocked. It's for the best. Theo responds to you in a way he doesn't to me.
The woman was feverish, maybe.
You're not feeling well. You must lie down and rest.
Mrs. Camden sat up straight.
No, the weakness has passed. I am recovered, according to my doctor. The illness was unrelated to my prior one. I am weak, yes. But it's from the realization that this is what I wanted all along. It's better for you to be with Theo. He's all yours.
A month after Sarah's conversation with Mrs. Camden, the arrangement had settled into a routine. Theo slept up in Sarah's flat each night, and had dinner there with her when he didn't have a business event to attend. Sarah visited the children on Saturdays when Mrs. Camden was out making calls, and if they passed in the courtyard, they nodded at each other and continued walking. Theo, meanwhile, was a madman at the office, juggling multiple commissions, overwhelmed. There were no more outings after the harbor cruise, neither with the children nor just the two of them. She'd suggested they bicycle in the park one Saturday, but he either didn't hear her or pretended not to. She comforted herself with the thought that it was only until the business was on its feet. By next year, Theo would be able to slow down and enjoy himself. She couldn't help but wonder if Mrs. Camden knew exactly what she was doing when she abdicated her role to Sarah. One night, when she knew Mrs. Camden had taken the train to the country for the weekend to visit friends, Sarah slipped down to read the children a goodnight story. To them, Sarah was a special friend, not a rival, and she appreciated that Mrs. Camden had done nothing to taint that relationship. Theo sat in a club-back chair in the study, smoking a pipe and reading the newspaper.
"Well, aren't you the very picture of a successful, satisfied man?"
he grunted.
"That damn Albany project will be the death of me. They want more revisions on the drawings. On top of it, McKim Mead have been asked to design the Golett building. We won't have any success if they keep on yanking out projects from right under our nose."
You said yourself it was a long shot. They have over 10 years' start on us. She walked over to him and leaned down to give him a quick kiss. He clasped her hand.
I do realize I brought all this on myself.
Is there anything I can do to help? He kissed the inside of her wrist before guiding her onto his lap. But she tripped over the chair leg, almost falling to the floor, before he grabbed her arm and caught her.
Ouch! Be gentle, kind sir.
She rubbed her arm, which was already turning red.
Sorry, my love.
He lifted up her arm and kissed the spot.
I'm turning into a beast these days. There I was complaining about not getting enough work, and now there's too much.
Once we hire the new draftsman and another junior architect, you'll have less to worry about.
You're right, as usual. Off you go. Say goodnight to the children, and then join me in a sherry.
The children were sleepy already. Christopher gave her a bubbly smile when she leaned over his crib. Luther cuddled close when Sarah sat on the side of his bed.
You have an ouch here.
The boy pointed to the inside of Sarah's elbow, at what was going to be a bruise tomorrow. I certainly do.
Now we match.
Luther rolled up the sleeve of his nightdress to show a purple circle on his upper arm. The boy's arm was no bigger in circumference than a cucumber, and as fragile. Did Miss Honeycutt do this?
No.
Luther looked over at Emily, as if for permission to speak.
He's fine, said his older sister. He was playing in the library among Papa's things. Papa doesn't like that.
Your father grabbed you. A flash from the day of the boat parade crossed her mind. When they descended from the brougham, Luther had flinched when Theo had held out his hand to help him down. It had only been a moment. A second. Emily rolled her eyes and gave an exasperated sigh.
Lula and Luther are always getting into trouble.
Although she was tempted to bring up the subject over sherry with Theo, she didn't. But later, upstairs in her sitting room, Sarah mulled over Emily's statement. The sewing machine sat in one corner. She hadn't had the energy or time to make anything new since the children's outfits. The outing in New York Harbor seemed like years ago. That day, the day of the boat parade, Theo had said something strange. Like the boy's flinch, she'd not examined it closely. A mistake. On the yacht, Theo had said what a mistake that would have been if he'd lost her. An odd choice of words. Whose mistake? She had been mistakenly sent away. Then Daisy had been found guilty of a similar crime. Daisy, with her romantic aspirations and helpful nature. What if Daisy had been railroaded, just as Sarah had, and was now sitting in prison for a crime she did not commit? Sarah sighed. She was overtired, overthinking things. Theo had lost his temper, as many men do, and taken it out on his child. It was a bruise, nothing else, and he probably regretted it the moment after. But that night she dreamed of Daisy calling to her, showing her the bruises on her pale arm, and crying out for help.
Chapter 30. New York City, September 1985. Bailey's work at Melinda's apartment was wrapping up. Luckily, most of the major design decisions had already been made, as Melinda was now distracted by plans for her blowout birthday party, to be held at the Palladium's Michael Todd room in 2 days' time. Renzo had stopped by the apartment with the building architect a few days earlier for an inspection, the first time they'd seen each other since the high tea at Kenneth's, and they'd been polite at first. But his laughter had gotten louder and crazier with each room he entered, which had made Bailey laugh. It had been a relief to make fun of the renovation, instead of feeling guilty for having given a grand old lady the facelift from hell. They'd met for coffee the next day, but kept the conversation light. Renzo was politely sympathetic about her father's refusal to be tested, and didn't push further. But the disappointment in his eyes made her want to burst into tears. He knew the truth about her, her weaknesses, her struggles, which was reason enough for Bailey to keep her distance.